to this event. We have David Deacon here, who is going to demonstrate and talk about and play lots of different banjo styles for us.
Yes.
Get your fill of banjos. David is a professor at City Oswego. He's a historian, but also a musician, been involved in folk music and old-time music since the mid-70s, early 70s. Okay. We won't go back further than that.
No,
and he is here with a kind of, cooperative sort of relationship between us and Syracuse University. Deb Justice here, who has a postdoc at Syracuse University, got a Mellon grant to do a whole series, and this is one part of it. There were a few events last spring, some of you may have come to, and I think we have another one on October the 10th. Todd Kluel will be here, fiddle, old-time stuff, so put October the 10th on your calendar. And also, so I don't forget, shameless plugs here, although it's not for us, tonight, if you haven't gotten enough music, at 8 o'clock at the Kirkland Art Center, the KAC, they have a concert, Cassie and Maggie McDonald. They have Celtic groups play lots of traditional music and contemporize it as well, and so that would be a great thing to go to. If you're a student and haven't been, you should really check out the Kirkland Art Center. It's a great resource, and even if they don't advertise, they have student rates. Go, tell them you're a student, and they will let you in on some kind of a discounted rate, I believe. So be sure to do that. Also, we run a regular jam session on Fridays here at Hamilton, usually in the afternoon, sometimes in the evening. If you're interested in joining that or want info about that, see me afterwards. We're going to be jamming today at 2 o'clock in Shabbat 108. So if you're hanging around and want to come by and just listen, or if you have an instrument and want to join us, Southern Old Time Appalachian music. So that's all the announcements. I'm going to let David then take it away with banjos.
Okay.
And thank you for being here.
The title of the series is Resounding History. And so what the idea is to bring archival sources into informed kind of modern music. And so this is what I'm doing. We're going to be, I'm going to be drawing from recordings made in a brief period from the late 20s to the end of the early 1930s. The birth of country music. Maybe a little before and a few years after the big recording session in Bristol, Tennessee that started recorded country music. And then I'm going to use that to dig a little deeper back into an earlier period. Banjo has a really kind of sordid history in some ways. Originally, the banjo became really popular in the 1840s as a kind of lead instrument in minstrel shows. This very troubled in a way history, but at the same time a very complicated aspect. There's recent work that's being done in minstrel shows that is trying to salvage something from them. There's a group, for example, called the Carolina Chocolate Drops that is doing some very interesting interpretations of some of the old material. To get started, let's just get started and start with a tune. You ready on guitar? Deb's going to help on guitar. The main style I play, which I think is the most popular kind of more traditional style these days, is called clawhammer. We call it clawhammer because Clarence Ashley in the border of southwestern Virginia and Tennessee called it clawhammer, and so his name kind of stuck. I'll explain some of the style, and you can see perhaps why it's called that. But the first tune, very popular tune, basically any old-time musician has played it and might be getting a little tired of it by now. Recorded in the late 20s by a group from Galax, Virginia, called the Costa Waltz and the Southern Broadcasters. I'll talk about the members of the group in a second. The lead banjo player, a man named Frank Jenkins, was a real hotshot. The tempo that he played was punishing. So I'm going to try that. John Brown's dream is coming. architect, I think.
Yeah.
That's the real reason why I think it's people wish it would stop being played so much. The Kosowaltz and his southern broadcasters were four musicians. One was a child who played ukulele and harmonica. Then there were two banjos and fiddle. The fiddler was named Ben Jarrell. His son, Tommy Jarrell, was somebody who in the 1960s into the early 1980s, a lot of people who wanted to learn old-time music traveled into this area around Galax to learn from. The lead banjo player was named Craig Jenkins, and his son, Oscar Jenkins, recorded with Tommy Jarrell. So we have this kind of direct connection back. The tuning. This is the tuning that Tommy Jarrell used. Banjos, ever since the 1840s at least, to change key, you change the tuning of the banjo. It's one of the inconvenient things about it. Frequently in old-time music, you change the tuning on the fiddle as well. But this one is a strange one because it has two drone strings. So like you have the high fifth string and then a low one because you don't really need that low string. And then it's just an open, in this case, an open A chord. G, C sharp, and E. It's the only tune I play in this tune. But because it changes the placement of the bridge and the tension on the head, it's very hard to retune out of this. So we're putting this away. strange banjo to do it. I just needed a banjo to use with this. This banjo itself, 1963, not an old-time banjo. The long neck was designed by Pete Seeger, and he used it, he said, so he could sing down an A. We were just talking a few minutes ago that the thing with these long banjos is you hardly ever see them without a capo. So you really don't need those long frets. In fact, it's tiring to play it that length. So they're kind of white elephants in some ways. But, you know, three banjos here, and they're all basically the same structure. Just an open frame drum with a neck attached. Two of these have frets on the neck. One of these does not. Still a lot of old-time musicians think that frets are unnecessary. They get in the way. So there's a big kind of resurgence these days in fretless banjos. This one is a little strange because this is the down and about the tuning that people were playing in 1850. Down a fourth from, if standard tuning is a C, this is G. And so early banjos had a very sort of soft sound. We think of banjos today as having this very crisp, high, piercing sound. But early on, I think in some ways, some of it's technological, that you didn't have strings that could hold the tension or the structure yet. Early banjos were simply gourds with a slice cut out and a head tacked over it. So probably they couldn't hold a lot of tension, but the banjo developed really almost more down to the guitar. It's nice, actually. It has a very nice deep resonance. Another part of the banjo is usually there's some sort of a piece of metal between the head and the body. Some banjos don't, and they make a very soft, sort of plunky sound. The brass ring helps with resonance and helps with sustain. But other than that, just very simple structure. These look like violin tuning pegs. They're not. They're actually geared. That's modern technology. But in any case, it's a very simple structure. Tone rings. This ring between the head and the body of the banjo people have fierce loyalties. They're different designs, and every manufacturer, because they were covered by patents, every manufacturer has a different configuration of pieces of metal. Some are hollow. Some have pieces of spun brass over them. And it became a kind of, in the late 19th century, almost a sort of technological war. Mine that I have today are all very simple. If you play bluegrass, and I don't, that's one style I have never learned. If you play bluegrass, those banjos usually have very heavy cast bronze ring and a back. Backs were added to banjos in the 1920s. That improves volume, which isn't necessarily an improvement. And it and also it sort of rounds out the tone and gives a more complex set of overtones. Bluegrass, based on a basic pattern of rolls, pluck up. I don't play it, so it doesn't really sound like bluegrass. But with using three fingers put into essentially a 4-4 rhythm, you have eight beats, eight eighth notes to the bar, but only three fingers, the changing syncopation and emphases that come from that lead to a very interesting sound. Earl Scruggs, the great innovator of bluegrass banjo, came up with a style of late 30s, early 40s, and became popular only after the Second World War. Even though I think probably the first sound that comes to mind, if you're thinking about it, the sound of a banjo is probably bluegrass now, because it so completely sort of took over kind of the popular perception of the banjo. So I'm going to go back a bit farther beyond that and kind of dispense with bluegrass for the moment. The basic technique, what was I doing? As some people have said, it looks like you wave your hand over an instrument and sound comes out. What you're doing is, it's in some ways a very simple motion. The basis of it is simple. It's down. The basic stroke of a banjo is nothing more than you hook your thumb, it catches the fifth string, and when you pick it up, it sounds the drone string, the fifth string. The fifth string always rings on an and, or almost always rings on the and. So, you know, you get into patterns like any banjo player, the first thing he learns is, they call this frailing. It's very simple. Pete Seeger called this the bum ditty lick. In a different tuning. Then you add things to it. Hammer-ons. Pete Seeger, guitar players use the term hammer-on and pull-off these days. Pete Seeger's the person who was supposed to have coined those terms. Hammer-on. So now you have one end, a one end, two end, or pull-off. And then the thumb can get into the action, too. Thumb doesn't always hit the fifth string. Sometimes it, as they say, you drop the thumb into interior strings. Call it double thumbing. If you're learning the banjo, you sit around and you do this for hours until you get it. Hope you don't have a roommate. And then by combinations, you get. I'll just play something quick. Complicated, but the basic motion is simple. This is the big clue to where the banjo comes from. What other European lute-like instruments do you know that you strike with your fingernail rather than pluck up? There's a folklorist named Cecilia Conway who's written a wonderful book tracing African connections to the Appalachian banjo. And she has found examples of African instruments that are played this way, also sometimes with a short drone string. This was also the style of the early minstrel shows. They called it a stroke style. That term has sort of passed out of use, except for people, reenactors, and people taking on things like minstrel show music. I would not do minstrel show music. I'm very uncomfortable about minstrel shows. It's in the history of the banjo, but it's something as a historical exercise, but it's something I'm uncomfortable about playing just as entertainment. because the history of the minstrel show, on one hand, it's real cultural borrowing that early banjo players claim that they had learned from slaves. And the current opinion is that they probably did. But at the same time, what the minstrel show was is it was humor and music that may have drawn seriously on African-American culture, but at the same time was used to demean it. And it's very difficult to reconcile that. Rhiannon Giddens, who plays banjo for the Carolina Chocolate Drops, though says she doesn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so it's there's some use to exploring this. Minstrel shows. Let's take the style back. A lot of what, you know, in elementary school, we sang as folk songs. Probably one of the first songs I learned on guitar was Old Dan Tucker. Think of that as a folk song. That's a minstrel show song, published in the early 1840s by Dan Emmett. Dan Emmett would go on to write, among other things, Dixie. Born in Ohio, working in New York City. Just play a little bit of it. Ice cream truck that comes around in the summer. Playing. Sheet music of this, we have some real clues. There's a book published in the 1850s that, of instructions compiled by Thomas Briggs of Boston, published after his death. It's the first major banjo instruction manual. In the 1850s, there are a bunch of musical, piano without a master and that things like that. And this one, there are a couple. Probably printed as kind of etudes. They fit very comfortably on the banjo, and I think they're really probably meant more for practice than performance. The clue is the scale at the beginning of this one. Thank you. is jig? In American language, a jig is simply a sort of clog dance. It's they don't use it like the Irish use a jig to mean something, mostly in 6/8. It's an interesting sort of clue to how things sounded. And we know to tune it this way because that's the way he put it in the manual. The stroke style in the North only lasted briefly, it seems. By the 1870s, people were starting to play it like a guitar. And banjo was becoming, by the 1870s, a kind of polite instrument that made for women. This is a 12 inches across on the head. Sometimes they're made as small as 10. And designed to be, you know, comfortable for a woman, whether, you know, if that was really necessary, I'm not sure. But they became very respectable and were adorned with all sorts of fancy inlay. And this is when, 1870s, 1880s, banjos became really chic. But they weren't generally played like minstrel show banjos. They were played. And Mendelssohn, Brahms, Liszt, however you put Liszt on the five strings, I'm not sure. But classical, there were classical pieces arranged for banjo, and then later simple ragtime pieces as well. On the stage, the banjo was being developed, competitions from the mandolin. Now, by the 1890s, people were stringing banjos with steel strings, like the mandolin, and gradually, if they were only strumming chords for an audience, they left off the fifth string, turned it into a fairly long-necked, but four-string banjo, just for strumming chords with a pick, and they were called plectrum banjos. A little later, shortened neck, tuned the same as a viola. These became an element of rhythm and harmony in jazz bands. Punch out loud chords, almost always with a resonator on the back. Irish musicians eventually picked those up too, and that's, if you talk about an Irish banjo, it's a tenor banjo, a jazz banjo. But tuned down, in Irish music, it provides a melody an octave below the fiddle. Let's take it out of this, because in the North, the banjo sort of quickly evolves into other things. One of the ideas is that some people have said that the banjo, the southern mountain banjo, because the style is almost the same as the minstrel banjo, that probably it evolved out of minstrel shows. But current scholarly opinion is that probably there was a parallel development. Well, we know for one thing, the person who takes the credit, at least, for inventing the five-string banjo, Joel Walker Sweeney, his name is, he claimed to have put the fifth string on the banjo. But he traveled through southwestern Virginia. He was from Appomattox. And so very early minstrel shows were being performed. But there's also a theory that there's a more... A sort of cultural trading going on at a very local level. And this is what Cecilia Conway has written about, pointing out that sometimes repertoire in African American and white communities in the same region are very similar. And Tommy Jarrell, a banjo player from, again, the border of Virginia and Tennessee, named Doc Boggs, claimed to have learned from African American musicians, and Clarence Ashley, who in some ways is the real a real really central figure, I think, plays a tune that's very similar to versions of the tune that are played not very far away. I'll come back to Clarence Ashley. I want to go now to the transition from minstrel shows. I don't think that one excludes the other. I think that probably both things were happening. Minstrel shows traveled through the South, medicine shows, and surely some of the repertoire is the same. But also, there is both a kind of northern popular music influence and I think a more southern local influence as well. A song, one of the early stars of the Grand Ole Opry was named Uncle Dave Macon. He comes up very much out of this minstrel show tradition. One of his songs from adapted from a minstrel show song, a song is called Jordan is a Hard Road to Travel. Dan Emmett wrote a version of it in the early 1850s. You can date it because it mentions Franklin Pierce. I mean, how many songs do you know that mention Franklin Pierce? Also, the controversy over fishing off the Grand Banks of Newfoundland that Daniel Webster helped negotiate. Okay, Jordan is a Hard Road to Travel. Just a couple verses of Emmett's. Minstrel shows have a strong element of social criticism, that they may have been, you know, gross exaggerations and caricatures, but also they took on a lot of issues of the day. And this is something that Uncle Dave Macon picked up on too. United States, and settle the fish question according, give the British all the bones and the Yankees all the meat, stretch back to the other side of Jordan. Take off your coat, roll up sleeves, Jordan is a hard road to travel. Take off your coat, roll up sleeves, Jordan is a hard road to travel. There's been a great commotion the last year or two about the great presidential election. Frank Pierce got elected, sent a hasty plate of soup to his opponent on the other side of Jordan. Take off your coat, roll up sleeves, Jordan is a hard road to travel. Take off your coat, that's the 1850s version. Uncle Dave starts with a joke. Yeah.
Do you know the Civil War version that's on Richmond is a Hard Road to Travel?
I haven't heard it, but it's a mark of how popular that song was.
Yes.
I've seen it as campaign songs, parodies of it as campaign songs.
Yeah.
It had as far away as a newspaper in Maine once. It had that sort of currency. These, you know, like all of the different words for turkey and the straw, there's different sets of lyrics. Starts with a joke in a way. I'll sing to you a brand new song all about the 2% thing. We have the pie, we'll get by. Highways, raising quite an alarm. Get a countryman educated just a little when he ain't gonna work on the farm. Is their tongue twisters. And I think that's intentional. that you really have to sort of, they required some dexterity to, verbal dexterity to get through them. I want to go one more sort of popular influence here. When I was first learning, there was somebody who was kind of a cultural hero almost for some reason in the mid-70s named Charlie Poole. We first heard him probably from recordings by the New Lost City Ramblers, Mike Seeger, John Cohen, and Tom Paley was a banjo player, and also a very strange countercultural group called the Holy Modal Rounders. In the folk song revival, the New Lost City Ramblers were kind of respectable, and the Holy Modal Rounders were self-consciously weird. Peter Sample, banjo player and fiddler for them, he just released a new album in his late 70s. He's still very active. But my teacher was a great fan of the Holy Modal Rounders, so I got a lot of that early on. But he played in a three-finger style, different from Clawhammer. He's picking up, like in the classical banjo or the later bluegrass banjo, not with the rolls that you play in bluegrass, but with but just sort of punching chords. He apparently caught a baseball without a glove at one point, and his hand never healed properly. So he's limited partly by the shape of his hand. A Tin Pan Alley version of Frankie and Johnny. Oh, Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts. They had a quarrel one day. Johnny said to his friend, let me start that again. Oh, Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts. They had a quarrel one day. Come on, Johnny, please stay. Oh, I know I've done you wrong, but please don't go away. And Frankie cried, and Johnny sighed. Yeah, I'm going away, I'm going to stay. I'm coming home. Gonna miss me, honey, in the days to come. When the winter winds begin to blow, the ground's covered up, the snow gonna think of me. Gonna miss me now, my loving man. Man, your hour has come. Underneath her silk kimono, she drew a 44 gun. These love affairs are hard to bear. Oh, Johnny ran down the stairway. Come on, Frankie, don't shoot. Frankie took aim with her 44 four times when a Rudy toot-toot. Johnny fell, and Frankie yelled, yeah, you're going away, you're going to stay. Coming home. Gonna miss me, honey, in the days to come. When the winter winds begin to blow, the ground is covered up, so don't think of me. Gonna miss me now, your loving man. Gonna miss me, honey, in the days to come. Oh, bring on your rubber tired horses. Bring on your rubber tired hacks. Take my Johnny to the graveyard. I shot him in the back with a great big gun. Went to run. Bring on all your policemen. Take me right away. Lock me up in your dungeon cell. Throw that key away. Johnny's dead. Because he said, I'm going away. I'm going to stay. I'm coming home. Come miss me, honey, in the dead. Probably missing some teeth. I think. He mumbled. And finally, the son, I think, of one of his band members published a book of lyrics. And then it let out the secret for all of us. I think some of the appeal of him was he was very difficult to understand. He got a contract in Hollywood to work on soundtrack for a movie, went out for weeks drunk, and he ended up with a heart attack or something at the end of it and died. Unfortunate man. Okay, let's get into what I want to do is get into, this is all popular music stuff. One of the things that's going on with in early country music, one of the reasons why it's so interesting is that recording companies didn't really know what they were doing. Clarence Ashley, the banjo player, went to New York and somebody asked him, so did they know, have a sense of what you played? And he said, no, I could have played anything. They really didn't know. They didn't care. And so he recorded some interesting things. This is one that had a number of variants in the African American community in North Carolina that Conway discovered and recorded. It sort of imitates bird calls, which is interesting. One of those core tunes, again, recorded in the late 20s. Clarence Ashley, back in the early 60s, the folklorist went back to Ashley, found him still performing locally, not playing out much. And they recorded a big double record set. And on that is the introduction of Doc Watson, great jazz guitar player, called Music at Clarence Ashley's. He recorded under the name Tom. So on the old records, he's Tom Ashley. But, banjo players are very thankful for model railroads. Because there's a hook. So you have a capo for your fifth string. Okay. Called the Cuckoo Bird. Was very popular in its day, to the point that even Janis Joplin recorded a version of it. Very different from this. Holds up, doesn't it? it's a neat song. Again, I'll finish off with one. sake of a different style, Doc Boggs played in a idiosyncratic style. It's a three finger style, but not like Charlie Poole and not like bluegrass. He didn't care about formal pitches either. He tuned his banjo to suit his voice. And so if you have perfect pitch, it's difficult, right? And part of his idiosyncrasy is the sorts of tunings he used. That's one of his favorites. It's a D sus 4, right? D, G, A, D, F sharp on the drum. What was that?
Okay.
But you use it to play against the third, the major third, you play a minor third in the melody. And it gives it a